Have you heard?
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 Welcome to Have You Heard? I'm Jennifer Berkshire.
And I'm Jack Schneider.
And Jack, while I've been at work on this episode, I've been experiencing a disturbingly familiar feeling. And that is that to me, it feels as though the world is on fire. And yet, even the people in our education corner of the world don't really understand the magnitude of what's happening.
Yeah. One of the things that I think is so interesting and important about this episode is that much of the current threat to public education posed by vouchers has been presumed to be confined to deep red states, right? To states where there is a large conservative majority in the state legislature. However, as today's episode will make clear, there are ways of bringing that threat to purple states and blue states. So, for instance, if all of a sudden what you get is a change in the way that we understand charter schools and make it possible to declare that religious schools and other private schools are charter eligible, then you've made it possible in states like Massachusetts, where there is no voucher bill on the horizon, to envision a future not too far from now in which private religious schools are receiving state dollars.
Well, our most astute listeners have no doubt already figured out that we're headed to Oklahoma, where the nation's very first publicly funded religious charter school was recently approved.
And this has implications not just for Oklahoma, but eventually in the long run for all 50 states, particularly if, as many expect, this ends up at the Supreme Court.
Well, I mentioned that even people in our world might not understand what a big deal this is. And, you know, recently there was a big expose in Politico about how conservative legal scholars, and one in particular, Leonard Leo, plan to use this case to basically batter down the separation between church and state once and for all. And this really gets at a frustration that I feel right now, that folks in the education world don't really have enough understanding of the larger political context of what's happening. And then I don't know anyone in our circles who really reads Politico, right? They're reading Education Week and Chalkbeat and watching Abbott Elementary. And so the folks who are covering this stuff from the political point of view, to them, the school part is really a mystery.
Yeah. And so I think one of the things that we'll be seeking to do in this episode is really tie these two different strands together, right? Thinking about the school's piece and the implications for not just the experiences of students, but for the system as a whole, and then trying to connect that to the larger political effort to undermine the separation between church and state that has manifested in legal efforts and policy efforts, both at the federal level and at the state level.
Well, it sounds to me like we better head to Oklahoma. Jack, have you ever been to Oklahoma?
Many times, Jennifer. It's so often that people often mistake me as a Sooner.
Now to the main event. We're headed to Oklahoma, which will soon be home to the nation's very first taxpayer-funded religious charter school. The stars of this episode are part of a lawsuit to keep that school from opening, but first, a little more background. St. Isidore of Seville Catholic Charter School is a virtual school that will be run by the Catholic Church, providing online Catholic education to kids across the state. And to say that St. Isidore's is mired in controversy would be, well, an understatement. The Catholic Archdiocese of Oklahoma City applied to open the charter school, knowing it would invite dissension and litigation and it got both. The legal effort against the school is being led by Americans United for Separation of Church and State, along with the ACLU, the Education Law Center, and the Freedom From Religion Foundation. Melissa Abdo is one of the plaintiffs in that case. She's a native Oklahoman, and she has been an outspoken advocate for public education since her now college-age daughter started school and ended up in a very crowded kindergarten classroom.
I got started because our kindergarten classes were really big, and I just wondered why is this happening? It's a lot of little five-year-old bodies in a space, and kind of started going to the state capitol, talking about funding and quality teachers. My mom was a public school teacher, and being an advocate led me to running for school boards. I serve on our local school board. I've been on there for about 10 years, and I think it's so important. It's kind of been a constant fight in Oklahoma. Of course, our lawmakers change all the time, but our issues seem to stay the same. And we're always advocating for more funding and quality teachers and really trying to stop the current focus of privatizing and of shifting our public dollars into private schools.
Another key detail in our story, in addition to being a member of both the Jenks Public Schools Board of Education and the Board of Directors of the Oklahoma State School Boards Association, Melissa is also Catholic.
I love my faith, and I was just kind of disappointed to see the Catholic Church go in this direction. I just don't think it's right. I think there's a very valuable lane for faith. I'm not opposed to Catholic education. I have a lot of friends. I have family members who have their kids in Catholic schools, and I think that's wonderful. I remain confused at why they believe it okay and appropriate to ask taxpayers and people of other faith to fund Catholic education. I just feel so strongly that that's not right. I knew I could kind of sense that there was this tie, just comments I would see from our state leaders, from our governor, that this is an anti-Catholic, we're discriminating against Catholic Church, and that is not it at all.
Melissa is one of eight individual plaintiffs named in the lawsuit, along with the Oklahoma Parent Legislative Action Committee, a pro-public education statewide nonprofit. Joining Melissa is the Reverend Dr. Lori Walke. Lori is a native Oklahoman. She grew up in Moore, just outside of Oklahoma City, and her roots in the state's public schools are deep.
I am a teacher's kid and a teacher's sister. When my mom got out of the classroom, she also served as a board member for 15 years. I am a dedicated public school volunteer in our local elementary, neighborhood elementary school, as well as in some of the high schools that are close to us. And I am also a pastor. And I am a pastor who cares deeply about religious freedom, which protects our right to practice the religion of our choice, and also to not practice the religion of someone else.
But it's really her faith that led Lori to join forces with Melissa and the other plaintiffs in this case.
Mayflower Congregational United Church of Christ is a progressive collection of believers. We believe that we will not be judged on the rightness of our beliefs, but on our commitment to doing justice, walking humbly, and loving mercy. We have about 500 members, and we are very dedicated to living our values, extravagant welcome, offering grace that we have ourselves so generously received. We are very committed to inviting others to join us, but we are equally committed to making sure that nobody has to do that.
As for Americans United for Separation of Church and State, Rachel Lazar, who runs the show there, says that the principles involved in this effort to create a publicly funded religious school are so foundational that her group had no choice but to get involved.
This is a case about whether the public education system in America that we are so proud of and that serves as a glue for the different types of people we are, that brings us together and teaches us our shared American values, will transform one day into religious education that means primarily favoring one type of religious belief over others in a country that promises religious freedom.
But just like with Melissa and Lori, Rachel's motivations here aren't solely about principle. Public education and the pluralism it represents means something really personal to her.
this is a case about public education, which is also near and dear to my heart as someone who attended public schools in Chicago and sent her kids to public schools in Washington, D.C., and who learned from that experience, who learned to coexist with people who are different from me, and for whom that experience was formative in how I conduct myself relationally with people today. But also as someone who loves and has benefited from America's promise of religious freedom. I am Jewish, and my ancestors fled religious persecution from Eastern Europe and found a home in America that they could thrive in, thanks to religious freedom. So like a lot of American Jews, I feel a real debt of gratitude to America for welcoming us and providing us safety and security and the ability to sort of play as equals. And I certainly feel driven to give that back to this country. So when in one state, Oklahoma, there's all of a sudden the nation's first religious public charter school, we at Americans United knew that we had to step up and put an end to it so these don't pop up all across the country.
Okay, so now you've got a sense of the who and the why behind this case. But I was eager for more local context. If you're a regular listener to this pod, then you know that Oklahoma has been generating education headlines of late with disturbing regularity. In fact, we dropped by just two episodes ago to meet a parent activist who was driven off of the sidelines by the extreme and dangerous rhetoric of the state's top education official. That would be Ryan Walters. Walters, by the way, is a big backer of the Catholic charter school. In other words, Oklahoma is ground zero right now for the school culture wars. But Melissa Abdo says that that does not necessarily translate into the idea that the state and its residents should be funding religious education.
It does not feel on the ground like a popular idea. We talk to our networks of friends, and I always wonder, am I just in a bubble? Because nobody likes this idea. And in fact, Oklahoma voters voted against the idea of publicly funding religion a few years ago on a state ballot measure. I actually think that that's contributing to this feeling. It feels like people aren't paying attention. What I hear is people say, there is no way that can happen. It's almost like this is so ingrained in us, the separation of church and state, and that we would never have publicly funded religious schools, that people are astounded. I don't think they realize it is right here. It is right here, and we are dangerously close to this watershed moment, not just in Oklahoma, but across the nation, and that it's so far-fetched in most people's minds that they don't understand that we're here.
We've pointed out before on this show that most of our state constitutions are pretty clear on this question of what kind of education the state must provide. And Oklahoma is particularly clear. I've got my copy of the Oklahoma Constitution right here, and it says that the legislature shall establish and maintain a system of free public schools wherein all the children of the state may be educated. These schools, by the way, are required to be non-sectarian. That means free of any particular religion. And the state law that governs charter schools in Oklahoma says the same thing, no religion. Melissa says that is precisely the idea, that it is the state's responsibility to ensure that all children get an education that is under attack today.
The government's role is to create a system of public schools that are free and open to all students. You can choose that or you can choose something else. And if you choose a private school setting, that's fine. I'm not opposed to that. I don't hear anyone saying they're opposed to parents having the right to choose that. But when you're talking about public funds being used in a private school setting where the public has no oversight or no say, and where this money that is set aside to educate all students, but the private schools are allowed to choose which students they want to educate and who they want to exclude, that's not appropriate.
Now, if you've been following the raging debate over school vouchers in, say, Texas, this all feels very familiar to you. You'll often hear critics of vouchers say that this isn't actually about school choice, but school's choice, as in the schools do the choosing. Well, this has particular relevance in this story because this virtual Catholic charter school is going to be run as an instrument of the church. Its stated mission is to lead students to, quote, know that human persons are destined for life with the Holy Trinity, but that in freedom, an individual may reject God's invitation and end up in hell, end quote. I'm just going to pause here so that you can process that. So here's the thing. Once you start calibrating your school admissions along the lines of who's headed north and who's going south, if you know what I mean, you are going to end up excluding a lot of kids. Here's Reverend Lori Walke again.
I am the pastor to some really remarkable teens and youth, some of whom are queer and non-binary. I am a pastor to families in my congregation that consist of two moms and two dads, trans couples. And because of that, I have an obligation to speak out against taxpayer-funded religious schools, because religious schools have a track record of discriminating against students who do not ascribe to particular dogmas, doctrine, or creeds. The bottom line is that all children deserve a free and quality public education. And while we have certainly some room for improvement, our public schools offer that, a free and quality education to all students. And religious schools simply do not have to do that. They can and they do refuse to educate children because of different beliefs and practices and traditions, family structure. By giving taxpayer money to schools like that, the state, the government, is endorsing that particular religion. If one of the kiddos that belongs to my church goes to one of those schools, they could unenroll that kid. They could reject that kid from even enrolling in the first place because they attend a church led by a woman.
Rachel Lazar of Americans United for Separation of Church and State says that this question of which kids the school will and won't accept is actually about something really fundamental.
Alongside of reserving the right and saying they will discriminate against LGBTQ students, St. Isidore in their application has also reserved the right to discriminate against students with disabilities, which public schools cannot do. Here, what we're facing isn't just a threat to public education in terms of like it's changing forms, but it's changing in a way that reinforces traditional power structures and that threatens those of us who have less power and less security in our society.
Okay, so Jack, I want to bring you back in, and I happen to know that you are at this very moment teaching a course on institutional change. And I know I speak for many in our vast listening audience when I ask, I wonder what Jack, from his perspective as an expert on institutional change, makes of this whole effort to change the way we not just fund schools, but really think about them.
Wow, that's a real UMass Amherst embedded pitch there, Jennifer. Yes, right. Come study in one of the nation's leading land-grant public universities. Yeah, I think that it's an important perspective to bring here. And I would say that generally speaking, when we're talking about institutional change, it requires shifts in legal structures, policy structures, and culture, and that it's important to think about the role that elites and interest groups play here, and particularly in legal structures and policy structures. Certainly, there's a role that elites play in trying to change the culture, particularly through media, and we've definitely seen that through the creation of a new kind of right-wing ecosystem over the past couple years in popular media and social media. But in this case, I think it's worth talking about long-standing efforts to change not just legal structures, but to change the balance of power on courts and most of all on the Supreme Court. So if you're able to do that, and that is something that elites tend to have outsized influence in doing, And you can then manage to change some of the policy structures that exist. In this case, it would be a policy structure at the state level. Then what you're hoping for is that 1 year down the road, 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road, maybe it's a generation down the road, that the culture will follow because the world that people inhabit will change and that people will acclimate to the new world that they are living in. And we see this all the time. We see this whenever there is a large-scale change in the way that Americans live, in the ways that they are forced to act in our society, that there is inevitably a kind of lag and resistance. But we often see change over time in cultural practices. And again, that's because of habituation, that we get used to the environments that we're inhabiting, the political environments, the social environments, the legal environments. And for the past 100 years, we've been living in a country that really firmly believes that we should not be channeling public dollars to religious schools. Now, we didn't always live in that world. That, again, was a conscious effort to change legal and policy structures. We've talked previously on this show about the Blaine Amendment and the so-called baby Blaines across the states and Supreme Court challenges. And what emerged over time in a kind of natural evolutionary way was a new culture. Right, we could talk about how the Blaine Amendment originally was a kind of anti-Catholic nativist reaction to changing immigration patterns, but that isn't how most Americans today interpret our legal and policy frameworks that deny funding to religious schools. Right, they see it as instead a way of shoring up a system of democratically oriented schools that ensure pluralism and actually allow for different kinds of religions to coexist together.
Well, Jack, I can't really say that you made me feel any better at all, but I hope that UMass has a big enough classroom for all the people who are going to want to sign up to come and study with you.
That's right. That's right. We'll do the 800 number at the end.
Now back to our special guests, as they have been very helpfully explaining, the St. Isidore of Seville Catholic Charter School will be run according to the tenets of the Catholic Church, which means that the school reserves the right to exclude any kids whose own lives or the lives of their parents don't line up with those tenets. But here's the thing. This has implications way beyond who gets to go to St. Isidore or what they'll learn when they log on. Because the idea of a school that's run as an instrument of the Catholic Church extends to how employees are treated. That's right, it's time to talk about the ministerial exception. Rachel, take it away.
So the ministerial exception is a court-created doctrine that's been read into the First Amendment Free Exercise Clause. And it was actually created to allow houses of worship to have freedom over who they employ as ministers. Unfortunately, religious extremists are trying to expand the ministerial exception to make it apply to all teachers who teach in religious schools, no matter if you teach, you know, math or science, or and you have no ministerial duties at all, or if you're the janitor, anyone. And we're worried about this moving into religious hospitals as well, and covering every employee of a religious hospital. We're talking about large volumes of people where an employer deploys the ministerial exception. They get around every single employment protection that exists for workers. And that's really important to understand. Everyone they get out of.
So let's just allow that to sink in for a minute. Remember back in the Obama years when we were always hearing about how we needed to weaken teachers' unions for the right reasons? Well, we have officially arrived at the logical endpoint of this kind of thinking, because teachers/ministers at this state-funded Catholic charter school will have no employment rights at all.
Why do our laws create these protections and have these anti-discrimination and other sort of employment protections? Because in America, we come and try to fill in for where people are more vulnerable. and to restore equality, where we need to put the thumb on the scale a little bit to restore it. But what religious extremists are trying to do is to use this ministerial exception to circumvent these protections. And again, to undermine the equality that America is striving towards.
By now, you may be thinking to yourself, well, this sounds not so good. But how big of a deal is it really? After all, this is just one Catholic charter school, and if the lawsuit we've been hearing about is successful, it may never even open. Alas. As I mentioned way back at the start of this episode, proponents of this vision of publicly funded Christian schools have a plan that ends at the Supreme Court with a dramatic change in the interpretation of the separation of church and state. Rachel says that the movement's big plans are reflected in the amount of money being spent and influence wielded.
Here, what we are actually fighting, and we've added up the annual revenue of the groups who we're working against, is a $1 billion shadow network. A $1 billion shadow network of groups, like a profoundly strong infrastructure that is fighting not just to impose one narrow religious view on all of us, which is anti-American and anti-religious freedom, but which is trying to turn back America's progress towards achieving its promise of equality for all. The group that is representing the virtual charter school board, Alliance Defending Freedom, is part of this $1 billion shadow network and really a leader in it. They were responsible for bringing the 303 creative case before the Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court granted an unprecedented constitutional right to businesses to discriminate against LGBTQ plus people. They also represented Hobby Lobby in that case that denied government promised birth control access to women. And I think it's just important to understand that an outside group like them were the ones who had to come in, because even the Republican Attorney General in Oklahoma supports church-state separation and views this as a violation of the state's promise.
Rachel was alluding there to Oklahoma's Republican Attorney General, Gentner Drummond, who also sued to stop the state from establishing and funding a religious charter school. And I'm going to read a quote from that lawsuit. Here goes. "Make no mistake, if the Catholic Church were permitted to have a public virtual charter school, a reckoning will follow in which this state will be faced with the unprecedented quandary of processing requests to directly fund all petitioning sectarian groups." Melissa Abdo says that it isn't hard for lots of Oklahomans these days to envision a slope that is very slippery indeed.
I think our current state superintendent, Ryan Walters, has done a good job of showing people exactly what can happen. Every chance he gets, he talks about, we're going to bring the Bible back into public schools. We're going to bring God back into the classroom. And what someone said to me just the other day is, you know, if that were to actually happen, it would take about 60 seconds for us to start fighting over which version of the Bible are we bringing into the schools and whose version is right and whose version is wrong. I think people can see the rabbit hole that we go down with that pretty quickly, and they don't want it, but you feel a little helpless to fight it. Sometimes I even wonder, are the people in our leadership and our positions of power that are so adamantly pushing this, are they really pushing faith, or are they more interested in the money that's behind that idea? Because sometimes the money seems to be the driver and the religion is just the vehicle that we're going to use.
That question about what's driving all of this is one that Reverend Lori Walke has been contemplating from her vantage point as a person of profound religious faith, the sort of person who quotes scripture and peppers her speech with references to extravagant welcome and walking humbly. And from where Lori sits, there's something profoundly wrongheaded about this attempt to legislate a particular faith.
This particular issue that we're talking about, this publicly funded religious charter school attempt, is part of a larger movement of white American evangelicals to create what they have called in the past a moral majority, a religious right, that they ultimately would like to create, from what I can tell, a white Christian theocracy instead of an American democracy. And this is all part of the plan to get into public money, to start particular religious education and indoctrination. They do seem to think that Christians are to be known because they are hanging the Ten Commandments in every classroom, that teachers should be leading particular prayers using particular language, and that is how people will know we are a Christian nation. And that is befuddling to me, in part because we have Jesus saying explicitly that those who follow him will be known by their love. By this, they will know you, that you have loved one another as I have loved you. And that doesn't have anything to do with coercion. It is, in fact, the antithesis of coercion.
Jack and I often joke on this podcast that we are the bad news bears, reliably bringing you down episode after episode. Well, this installment is really no exception when you think about it. Here we are filling you in on an incredibly well-funded, well-organized effort to usher in a theocracy, rolling back any progress that's been made to realize the dream of equality in the process. But here's the thing, that vision is also extremely unpopular. And so as bleak as this report has been, there is actually something to feel hopeful about.
This litigation is so important to me because the church has a role in defending the separation of church and state so that indeed people can live by freedom of conscience and that we are not coercing anyone into certain statements of belief or ways of living they don't actually believe in. And it is why indeed we need everyone to say, I have a dog in this fight, to say, I have a stake here. I have to ensure not only that I can believe what I want to believe, but that my neighbors are allowed to do that too. And so I just would encourage people to know that there are more people fighting for the separation of church and state than they know, but that they also have to do the work too. All of us need all of us to make it. So we all have to do our part here.
And while it may seem like we agree on absolutely nothing these days, especially when it comes to issues of education, as Rachel Lazar points out, Americans are actually remarkably united on the question of keeping church and state separated.
The magnificent part of church-state separation today is that it's one of the rare places where we really do come together across all of our many differences. It really does unite us. You know, it's sort of remarkable the way this issue is one of the rare community builders. And if we just realized that we have the power of the majority and came together and used our voices around this issue, we really can win because we've got history and our constitution and our state constitutions on our side. So let's speak up, take action, come together to protect freedom without favor and equality without exception, which is what church-state separation clears the way for.
A big thanks to our special guests, Melissa Abdo, Reverend Lori Walke, and Rachel Lazar. And Jack and I will be right back to talk about even more reasons why you should be worried about publicly funded religious schools. And we'll be revealing the topic of this episode's In the Weeds segment for our Patreon supporters. Here's a hint. In a recent episode, Jack proclaimed that the era of standards-based accountability is over, to which some of our listeners said, "What? Not where I am." We put Jack on the hot seat in the weeds. If you'd like to listen in, just go to patreon.com/haveyouheardpodcast to become a supporter. So, Jack, there are obviously so many concerning things about this story, and you know from the episode that I'm particularly worried about the idea that we're now going to be classifying everyone who works in a school as a minister and that this will exempt them from whole sections of labor protection. But you've been thinking a lot about the 14th Amendment and how this story relates to that.
Yeah, for some of our listeners, the 14th Amendment applications here are going to be pretty obvious. The potential for discrimination against students is very strong, and the 14th Amendment ensures equal protection of the laws. If we have state funding, right, so there's state action here, going to private religious schools, and those religious schools are then treating different students in different ways based on things like their sexual identity, then what we see is essentially state-sponsored discrimination in violation of the U.S. Constitution. And that's something that we really need to pay attention to here, because if this eventually does get kicked up to the Supreme Court, they'll have to find a workaround for that. And it's important to track that legal reasoning, because if they do manage to find a workaround here, then they have suddenly created the potential not just for state-sponsored discrimination in schools, but for state-sponsored discrimination anywhere. There's another 14th Amendment angle here, which has to do with religious groups. So if you are taking state dollars and funding private religious education, then the 14th Amendment seemingly would require that you fund all religious groups that are interested in receiving state dollars to pursue their religious education programs. I don't see that being particularly popular in states like Oklahoma. I don't see Ryan Walters endorsing the creation of a state-funded madrasa, for instance. So then the question is, upon what basis will the state deny funding to religiously oriented, quote-unquote, charter schools? And religious groups would then have a kind of 14th Amendment case to make about being discriminated against on the basis of religion in state determinations around who gets a charter. Again, it will be really important to pay attention to the legal reasoning here, as well as to think about loopholes and workarounds and the very real fact that even if the legal reasoning asserts that every religious group needs to have the opportunity to receive a charter, the charter approval process can be constructed in a manner that is more conducive to some religious groups receiving charters than others. And there's just the kind of ordinary discrimination that can happen in a kind of de facto rather than de jure manner. And that, you know, it would be an uphill climb for any religious group that then is trying to assert that the denial of their charter application was based on their religious background rather than any number of other criteria that could be relatively vaguely outlined in charter authorization rules.
Well, Jack, I have to say that I went into this episode feeling already like my hair was on fire. And I really just, I stayed in that frame of mind through the entire process. And I still feel like that right now.
Yeah, this is not one of our uplifting episodes. Although I wonder how many of our episodes, if we went back and were to qualitatively code them, how many would be coded uplifting?
That's a really good question. Well, I know that people are eager to find out, will there be any uplift in the weeds? And the answer is sort of in a weird kind of way. This topic for our In the Weeds segment for our Patreon supporters came from a listener. Somebody wrote in and said, hey, Jack keeps saying that the era of standards-based accountability has come to an end, but sure doesn't feel like that from where I sit. So we decided that we would talk about that in the comfort and safety of the weeds. And if this interests you, all you have to do is go to patreon.com/haveyouheardpodcast. You'll see a list of all the extras you can get just by throwing a few dollars our way each month. We put together a custom reading list and a special entry for the weeds participants. And I know Jack's got something good in mind for this one. And if you subscribe at the $10 a month rate, we will send you a copy of A Wolf at the Schoolhouse Door. And that is, it's almost time for our new book to come out.
Yeah, so you might want to hold off on your $10 a month Patreon enrollment until the Education Wars comes out. By the way, you should start haranguing your local librarian and saying, we want to make sure that our library purchases not just one copy, because, you know, you could be on a long waiting list if there's only one copy, but a plethora of copies so that we can all continue to be part of this free democratic community that we have built here on Have You Heard, to ensure that that community is thriving and growing. Please make sure that you are a subscriber so that the latest episode drops in your feed. Tell somebody who you like, or maybe somebody who you don't like, to listen to the show. It tends to work in both directions. And, you know, my latest hobby horse is defeating the other Have You Heard show, which is, speaking of Uplift, I think it's a Christian Uplift show. You know, no shade to them, but let's just make sure that our Have You Heard is the first one that comes up when you search.
I thought your latest hobby horse was teaching a course on institutional change.
Oh, that's not new. That's something that has been in the works for quite a while, Jennifer.
On that note, I'm Jennifer Berkshire.
And I'm Jack Schneider.
This is Have You Heard.